the gag who drives it through.
We had the high notes on the park. That's how we became a great team together, you know. It was just unfortunate we never won anything.
Lane's in trouble, there's Steve Kirk. The super sub has done it again, and Motherwell are back in front.
Without supporters, you cannot play a game. They are a very, very important part of the club.
Jukovic on the chase, might get there. Handel is with it. Jukovic!
I remember to this day, it was unbelievable, and that's another reason I love going back to Fir Park, because you do get to interact with the supporters again, who were wonderful for me.
Chance here for Motherwell. This is Pettigrew, outnumbered though, still has it. Chance of a lifetime for Pettigrew, and it is there!
Yeah, obviously being on the podcast is everything I've dreamed of.
Goes through the middle though, Marvin Johnson, defenders backing off. Took a deflection! And there goes! Misjudged by Bell! Fir Park! Twisting! Shouting! Shaking!
Hello and welcome to the MSC podcast. Tonight, myself and Jay are delighted to welcome along Derek Watson. Derek, how's it going, mate?
Aye, not bad. Thanks for having us on, Andy. Cheers.
No problem. Well, over the course of tonight's episode, we'll take a look back, possibly quite briefly, in the dismal 2-0 defeat to Hamilton Accies. We'll look at this weekend's Motherwell Makes Music Festival, which has been organised by Derek himself. We're going to have an in-depth conversation about the OBFA, which should be repelled on Thursday, all going to plan. And we'll preview Sunday's clash with Celtic as well. We'll start with yourself, Jay, and have a look back at that game at Hamilton, which was...
too many.
Probably as disappointing an afternoon as we've had this season. The players really let themselves down. I think the manager possibly got a few things wrong over the course of the 90 minutes and certainly seemed to set up his team wrongly as well. It was grim.
Yeah, that pretty much covers it. I don't know if I've got much more to add than grim. I think before the game, when it was announced that Chief G had been dropped, I don't think anybody in the pub thought anything other than Ryan Bowman was in. I think to get there and find that Andy Rose was in and we were going to, you know, pretty much a 3-6-1 against Accies, just kind of, it was quite disheartening from the start. I think certainly every Motherwell fan I spoke to before the game and you know, in the early stages, nobody seemed to think that the way we'd set up was going to work. It became very clear through watching the game that it wasn't working. I think everybody expected changes at half time that didn't come. And I think we were, you know, we got what we deserved. We were incredibly poor. The players still have a job to do. I think Robertson got it wrong, but the players still have a big job to do. They didn't do it. I think to a man, everybody was below par. Some really, really poor performances out there. And it was just a really, really mediocre performance, a terrible result. And to me, it kind of had a bit of the Mark McGee's about it. You know, that kind of lining up. I don't really know what was the thought process. You know, we've kind of abandoned the fact that we've been doing well so far this season, giving Accies far too much credit, lined up for presumably a midfield battle that never actually happened. You know, refused to change it and just been really poor. And it reminded me far more of a Mark McGee team than it did a Stephen Robinson one.
Derek, it was interesting that we did seem to focus in the midfield, particularly given that Accies were without Dougie Imrie, were without Ali Crawford. They've obviously sold on Greg Doherty, so they're not the... I wouldn't say they were ever a midfield powerhouse, but they were strongest, certainly, in the middle of the park. Andy Patterson, who was sitting behind us at the game, actually said that it was almost as if we had set up for a midfield battle, despite the fact there wasn't really a battle there to be had over the course of the 90 minutes.
I thought it was a strange introduction for Andy Rose, to be honest. I thought that Robinson went for bigger players rather than players, you know, maybe like Biggie Romana, that would have got the ball on the deck and played some football over there. And I think when you seen him bringing him on, it was maybe a bit little too late, and he didn't do a great deal when he came on. But I think if we'd went for players that can get the ball on the ground, you know, and and pass it around and create chances, even Chief Che as well, it would have been a much better outcome from the start.
And do you think over the course of the week there was obviously a lot of positivity about the club, and rightfully so given the brilliant win over Hearts in the quarter final of the Scottish Cup? Do you think an element of that perhaps was maybe some of the players believing their own hype? I know two or three were mentioned in line for Scotland call-ups even in the Thursday press conference. Or do you think that's just the manager rightfully singing the praises of his players who are doing very well for him?
I think it's important that Stephen Robinson does come out and sing the praises of his players, you know. And I don't know your opinions on Richard Tate being called up to Scotland squad, but certainly he's done very well for Motherwell. Whether he's good enough for Scotland according to Alec McLeish today, he definitely isn't, but he might not be far off it. It's important that he does put these players in the spotlight, you know, maybe not even just for Scotland call-ups, but for future sell-on, you know. I mean, we all know how Motherwell will work for a sell-on club. It's important that he puts them in the public eye, but I don't know, maybe it was believing their own hype, or maybe it was a Scottish Cup hangover. I just think regardless of who we play, what formation we set up with, anytime you go over the Ackies, you've always got this feeling in the back of your mind that it's doom and gloom over there and we never really seem to perform.
Yeah, Jay, and on the players believing their own hype, but I suppose the manager's rightfully going in front of the press and talking up the guys. It's then down to the players, isn't it, to deliver on the park and back up what he's saying. Furthermore, the point about going to Hamilton, get out the car on Saturday and it's absolutely teeming down with rain. It's just grim, I suppose, going to the football when it's hammering down in rain and walking through a shopping supermarket car park isn't ever the place where I'm at my happiest, but it just seems significantly worse at Hamilton. And then you're greeted with the big queues as well, which I've taken upon myself to try and get some sort of explanation from Ackies over the last couple of days, but it is really like speaking to a brick wall. They're willing to blame everyone else apart from themselves, and that stance hasn't changed as of what, 8:15 on Monday night, so I don't think we're really going to get much progress there. But it's not a very pleasant place to visit, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, the whole queue thing, it's almost, it felt a bit like trolling, you know. I mean, we were there, actually left the pub a lot earlier than perhaps I normally would, as I had tickets for both my dad and my uncle, and they were parked up and already waiting outside the ground. So we were there about 2:55. The queue at that point was already from one turnstile to the other. The other turnstile being the pay at the gate one, which had nobody at it, yet you weren't allowed to use your ticket there. And then once we'd been standing in the queue for the ticket gate for about 15-20 minutes, they opened the pay at the gate one for tickets. So the whole thing just felt as though you were having the piss ripped out you before you were even in the ground. And then obviously to sit through 90 minutes of sort of mind crushing football didn't help. I mean, you know, I put a tweet up shortly after, and I stand by it. You know, I think that we're all Motherwell fans, we're all used to dross at times, and you can come away from games and you can say, right, that was a shit performance, but it happens, that's okay. But for me, I think it was bordering on unacceptable on Saturday. I just thought that it was that poor. There was no determination, no passion, no fight, and the football itself was grim. And you can say what you want about a plastic pitch, it will hamper injuries, you know, it will cause players to misjudge the bounce of the ball. But once you've got the ball on the ground, you can pass it, you can play football with it, and we didn't do it all day. So yeah, if we start to finish, it was just a dire day.
And I guess that's the big point, isn't it, Derek? Because you can say what you like about Ackies, there's points where you do stand there and think, this is what we're up against, is the shell balls aimlessly out the park or whatnot. But that was a team that went out there, they fought to a man, and they beat us, and can't take anything away from them on the park. They definitely deserve to win.
Oh, without a doubt, it was a very poor moral performance. But I mean, Ackies seemed to do what they needed to do to get the result. Focusing on Motherwell first and foremost, I thought that, I don't like to point fingers at players, but I thought Chrissy Cadden had one of his worst games in the Motherwell jersey, which is quite disappointing. You know, I always think that Cadden's got a great potential ahead of him, but his final ball on Saturday was really, really poor. As I said, I don't think any of the players really get past marks on Saturday. Maybe Trevor Carson if you're lucky, but no, Ackie's done exactly what they had to do. There's quite a physical side, but there's no doubt as well that the plastic pitch plays to their advantage. If you're training in that every week, you're certainly you're going to be used to it, and you're going to understand how the ball bounces and the speed that the ball moves at on it. It's an absolute shambles on that, but I mean, good workman doesn't play his tools, does he? So we can't keep going on about the pitch every time we go over there.
Well, we'll certainly be back in grass on Sunday when Celtic visit Fir Park. Jay, the defeat to Accies came 24 hours after Hearts had lost at Easter Road. It put us in a situation where we were 4 points behind Hearts with two games in hand, Hearts sitting in sixth place in the Premiership table. Aspirations for the top six were possibly heightened going into the Accies game. Now we look at it, we're still 4 points behind. We still have that one game in hand, but the games are going to come at us thick and fast, and very tough opposition as well. When you look at it, it's going to be Celtic, then followed by Rangers, a trip to St Johnstone, and then a home game against Aberdeen to finish before the split. Four very difficult games. I guess we're looking at a Celtic game thinking we need to get something to harbour any expectations of the top six.
Yeah, I mean, the pressure's off in terms of the top six now. Prior to the Accies game, I wasn't just hopeful, I was quite confident to reach the top six. I thought it was certainly within our grasp with a good result at Accies. But the result, and more to the point, the performance has, you know, for me, all but wrecked those chances. That's not to say it's not possible. Of course, if Celtic come to Fir Park on Sunday and we sneak a win, then suddenly you're looking at it thinking that it's back on. But that's such a massive task. However, you know, ever the eternal optimist, you just look back to the last time they came to Fir Park and we were within minutes of actually being, you know, the first team in ages to actually take a win off them. So they're certainly not unbeatable. They're incredibly poor at the back, as we saw during the Old Firm game yesterday. So there are holes there to be kind of picked at. There are opportunities there that we can create. We will get some chances, and you know, if your luck's in, then you can maybe nick something. They're certainly not quite the sort of invincible, unbeatable side that were sweeping all before them last season. They're certainly far more beatable this year. And maybe, you know, if you want to be top six, you look at teams like Kilmarnock. You know, Kilmarnock, who have already went and beaten both Celtic and Rangers. That's what you need to do if you really want to be cementing your place in the top six. So if we can't beat teams like Rangers, Celtic, Aberdeen, although we have already done so this season, if we can't get points against them, then we don't deserve to be in the top six anyway.
Derek, that being said, Celtic are on the back of a massive victory yesterday in the Old Firm match. That leaves them almost certain for the championships. They'll be buoyed by that and coming to Fir Park full of confidence, and when they are in full swing, they're a very dangerous animal.
Well, I actually think it might sound a bit strange, but I actually think that Celtic winning yesterday was good for us. I think if Rangers had they pulled out a surprise and had actually beat them, I know a lot of the Rangers fans were quite confident before the game. I think if they'd got a result yesterday, Celtic would have been coming to Motherwell having to respond. I think the fact that now they think that they've won the league again and there's no such thing as a title race, that it will play into our hands. I think that they might sit back a bit more. There's not as much pressure on them, you know. If they were down to, what would that have been, 3 points, I think. If Rangers had won yesterday, there might have been 3 points between them and Celtic. If it came down to that, they'd have to come to Fir Park and get a result. I'd like to think that they'll turn up next week and their foot will be off the gas a wee bit and we could take them by surprise.
I guess Stephen Robinson will be encouraged, Jay, despite the fact that the last meeting of the sides was a very comprehensive victory for Celtic at Celtic Park. But the two games that came before that, the cup final, which was decided on a couple of decisions, I suppose, and a great save from Craig Gordon from Louis Moult. Then the controversial penalty at the end of the game at Fir Park while Motherwell were leading 1-0. There was fine margins in these games, so Robinson already knows that Motherwell can go toe-to-toe with Celtic and run them very close.
Oh yeah, you know, as I said, they're not the same team that they were last year. Even, you know, the players that they've got, you know, Scott Sinclair, Moussa Dembele, a lot poorer this season compared to last year. you know, Dembele's one who, yes, he got that goal and went on to have a half-decent game, but he spent most of the first half, at least of that Old Firm game. You know, the big games that he's brought in for, he spent most of it as a passenger. Scott Sinclair, I think, has been incredibly poor this year for this level that he set last year. I'm sure we would all still take him in our teams, even although he is a diving bastard. But, no, I think, you know, they're certainly beatable. There's absolutely no question about that. Even when they were, you know, that invincible side last season, we still, you know, ran them a little bit close at times. So it's certainly not a game that you should just write off. You know, there will be folk, you know, the usual suspects on Steelman Online or Pye and Bovril, who write us off every game, and this will no doubt be this game will no doubt be predicted as a 5-0 defeat or something. But, you know, as I said, we can look back to that narrow, last few minutes of that game where we narrowly were sort of lost the chance to be that great, that team that ended their streak, and that should fill us with confidence, because that wasn't a one-off performance. It wasn't as though our luck was in a little bit, but it was more down to the performance we put in, the graft, the hard work, the battle and energy, a great performance by Trevor Carlson, of course. So if we could do that again, then yeah, why not, you know, put them under pressure, go out, Curtis Main, hassling the defenders. You saw, if you watched the Old Firm game yesterday, exactly what happens when you run down guys like Boyata. They will make mistakes. So yeah, I mean, again, yes, Saturday is a blow. It's a game that I don't think any of us want to dwell on. So if we can, you know, get back to what we were doing prior to the Aki's game, then we can at least go and put up a fight.
Right, well, we'll take the matters off Motherwell for now and look firstly at the Motherwell Makes Music Festival, which Derek has been grafting up very hard over the last few weeks and months. Derek, from someone that went last year, it was a highly enjoyable event, and I can only imagine the amount of work that's went into it. Some big names locally on the lineup again. It must be a very exciting week when you're in the lead up to the big festival.
Oh, totally. I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, the reason that I do it, first and foremost, is there's most people in Motherwell know I play in a band called the Banter Thieves. I really enjoy local music. I find myself going to gigs all over the country most weekends. So to give something back to the local community and actually save myself from travelling into Glasgow for a gig at the weekend, it always helps. I feel that there's not a great deal of venues or a great deal of places for young musicians or even older musicians, I suppose, from Motherwell to play. It's always, if you want to play a gig, you're destined to go into the town and go there. But why should you? You know, there's enough pubs on our doorstep that they should be putting on live music, and it seems to be a bit of a dying thing. So to give something back to the local community and give bands a platform to play on has always been the aim of it.
A nice element must be as well that you actually get to host a few events at Fir Park as well, with the Cooper Suite hosting on both the Friday and the Saturday evenings.
Without a doubt, aye. It's always good to give back to the club as well. When we decided we were going to do it this year, I thought it might not be an option to use the Cooper Suite or to use Fir Park, just because the way that the fixtures fell. The Celtic game was originally scheduled to be Saturday, so I thought that would be out of bounds. When we're looking at picking venues, we always try and get somewhere where we can keep the drum kit and the PA system set up for 2 days to save us having to move it, you know, on the second day. So I thought the Cooper Suite might be out, but when the match came moved to the Sunday, that was perfect. So that allows us to go in there on the Friday and Saturday and hopefully bring in a good few punters that will be putting more money back into the club.
And you'll obviously be expecting, with the game following the Sunday, the final day of the festival, that should certainly attract a few Well fans along to Jack Daniels for the final day, which kicks off, I think it's only a couple hours after the full-time whistle, if it's even
it's
as
not,
long
it's
as that,
not
I don't
even
think.
That, aye, it's only about 15 minutes after the final whistle.
Right, so you'll need to be quick.
I think the plan is to go in and set everything up before the match, and as soon as the game finishes, run down there and check out some live music. So it's it starts at 4 o'clock actually, and I think the game will probably finish about, I don't know, what, 3:45 if we're lucky.
I should maybe do a wee bit of research in that before before Sunday.
To be honest, I'm hoping quite a lot of folk come away from Fir Park in good spirits after his beating Celtic 2-3 and think they want to continue the party and head down to Jack Daniels.
Oh, fingers crossed. So I'll put you in the spot. Over the 3 days, I want you to pick a band from each day that we should all be definitely trying to check out.
This is where I have to remember who's playing which day, isn't it? I would say I'll go backwards. I'll start on the Sunday. There's a band from Motherwell. I think there's a couple of Motherwell fans in the band called Foggy City Orphan, and they've just finished touring with Shed 7. They're doing really, really well just now. They're fantastic. They're a real rocky type band. I think people will really, really enjoy them. They're playing in Jack Daniels after the match. I think they're probably not going to be on until about 10 o'clock. So if you go out straight for the match, you might not remember them if you're drinking all that time. but I'd recommend them on the Sunday. On the Saturday, there's a band from Edinburgh called Indigo Velvet. And they're playing up at the Cooper Suite. They're absolutely brilliant. I've seen them a few times now. They sold out the Liquid Rooms in Edinburgh 2 weeks ago, and they sold out a gig in Glasgow last week, and they're absolutely brilliant. They're doing a lot of stuff for Radio Scotland just now as well. So if you get the chance, I'd definitely say that they're my pick of the bunch on the Saturday. And on the Friday, I think it would be unfair to say the Banter Thieves. That's just a wee bit biased there. So I would go for a band called Luna the Professor. They're playing at the Cooper Suite as well. They're from Wishaw. They're really young. They're all about 18, 19. But they're really, really good musicians, really talented. They actually played last year, and it was the first time I heard them, but they've just grown and grown since then. The stuff that they're putting out is really, really impressive.
Good stuff. Well, that's Motherwell Makes Music, running between Friday, which is the 16th of March, through to Sunday, the 18th of March. Can you still buy tickets online at the moment?
There is, there's tickets online. It's motherwellmakesmusic.bigcartel.com. And I don't know if there's many Well Society listeners that are going to be listening to this, but certainly there's a discount available for Well Society members as well. I think yesterday Craig actually sent out an email detailing that, but if you go onto the site and if you're buying a weekend ticket that's priced at £11 for the whole weekend, if you put in the code Well Society then number one, you'll get tickets for £8 for the whole weekend.
Superb stuff, and that was a lovely kind of radio-esque kind of plug there where I just introduced you and you did the website, so that was... We didn't even have to rehearse that, so that was pretty impressive.
We'll be getting Tam Cowan off Radio Scotland next time.
We've been trying to organise a podcast on the Offensive Behaviour Act at football for quite some time. The thing that was stalling us, I suppose, was we wanted someone who backed the bill and someone that could argue the case against what essentially Jay and Derek will be doing over the next 20 minutes or so. Myself, cards on the table, my knowledge of it isn't anywhere near what these guys have. I'll be the kind of go-between over the next 20 minutes as we discuss this. Jay, the background to the Offensive Behaviour at Football Act, as far as I'm aware, it came in 2012 and it was aimed at reducing public disorder at football matches, and also focused on discrimination against racial groups and other behaviours that people would consider offensive. Is that a fair summary?
I'm impressed of, you know, where you've copied and pasted that from, Sparrow. Good job. No, I mean,
I wrote it down actually.
Yeah, you're right. It came in 2012. Rushed through, essentially. I mean, if you remember back, it was the Rangers played Celtic, and, you know, it was kind of labelled a bit of a shame game. I'll be honest, from memory, I don't remember, you know, what aspects of it made it.
It was the one
worse.
That...
I do remember that it was Neil Lennon and Ally McCoy squared up to each other. So that was the imagery of it. Now, what Neil Lennon and Ally McCoy squared up to each other has got to do with, you know, legislation against football fans is beyond me. But that was the sort of the imagery for it. And, you know, as a result, there was outrage throughout Scotland, and I include, you know, the many, many people in Scotland who are not football fans and who, you know, see football as being that. They see football as being, you know, the hooliganism of the 80s. They see it as being, you know, rife with sectarianism, and they are broadcast into their homes, you know, the two managers ready to batter each other. And that kind of allowed the Scottish Government to kind of rush through. It was a majority government at the time, you know, allowed them to rush through the OBFA. Absolutely, what you clarified there in terms of the kind of groups and the types of behaviour it's meant to crack down on. Yeah, it mentions, you know, hatred of groups of people based on religious affiliation, based on nationality, race, etc. But it doesn't actually provide any clarification on anything. And that's where the issues lie, first and foremost. I mean, you're talking about offensive behaviour, essentially. It's particularly recently, because it's about to be repealed, that the media in particular paint it as the sectarian bill. You know, it's an act about cracking down on sectarian behaviour and sectarian language. It absolutely isn't. I think on average about 22% of arrests under the OBFA are actually anything to do with sectarianism in the first place. The actual legislation is about offensive behaviour. Now, on paper, that sounds great. I'm sure all of us are quite happy, you know, not having offensive behaviour. But if you want to organise a podcast special for next week, and we'll get loads of guests on, and we'll sit, we'll press record, and we'll discuss what offensive behaviour is, and we'll only end the podcast once we've all decided. The podcast will never end, because there's no such thing as offensive behaviour. It's all perception, it's all context, and that's where the problem lies. Because when you have a bill that doesn't give any clarity whatsoever, and the wording of the legislation is available for all to see, if you've got that big a grayscale, then legislation just can't work, particularly in something like football. You know, at the end of the day, we've all... you know, we've all reacted to a refereeing decision with swearing and you know, gestures. We've all maybe flicked a V or a wanker sign at the opposition fans and things like that. Those are all technically, you know, free rein to see you arrested under the OBFA. And that's kind of what we're talking about. You know, it's a legislation that doesn't provide any clarity whatsoever and leads to the kind of confusion and basically the nonsense arrests we see en masse at times.
Derek, the mass arrests, or the kind of scrupulous, if you will, arrests, there's some horrendous examples of particularly young adults being prosecuted for what you would deem as the most minor thing. Life-changing scenarios for these people, under which any right-minded person would kind of question, why are people being offended by that, but why does that lead to criminal prosecution?
I think that's the real scary thing about it, Andy. I was on another podcast late last week talking about the OBFA and the effects it's had. At Fir Park, I think if you're not sitting in the East Stand and you're not surrounded by predominantly young working class males, if you're maybe in the main stand or even the Cooper Suite where it's a bit more of a family atmosphere, you might not, you know, see the how the act's been brought in first hand, because it might not affect you. But there's been a lot of examples at Fir Park. One that you might remember, or the listeners might remember, that always sticks in my mind is when Motherwell played Celtic. I think it was maybe a Friday night fixture. And then the next morning, or the following morning, or the Sunday morning, I think it was maybe the Sunday morning, front page of the Daily Record was a big headline, and it was something like 20 arrests at this fixture. Now, if you were at that fixture, I don't think there was anything out of the ordinary. You know, there wasn't any, I didn't see any violence outside, I didn't see anything particularly damning in the stands. But what I did see, which was concerning, was the Celtic fans ripping out the seats at Fir Park, and it was the match where, you know, the front of the south stand was almost looked as if they took drills in the stadium and removed part of the stadium. But the reason I'm touching on that is the next morning in the Daily Record, the headline was 20 arrested, and out of the 20 arrested, 18 of them were Motherwell supporters. I think probably the age range for the Motherwell supporters was probably between 16 and 24, maybe, if you're lucky. All these supporters were arrested under the OBFA. They were subsequently banned from football matches. Motherwell played Hamilton the following week, and these people that were arrested for absolutely no reason whatsoever. I should actually add that they weren't arrested on the night of the match. They were arrested the next morning. The police turned up to their doors with journalists, and one of the people in question that got arrested, know him really well, knew him for years, really nice guy, never been involved in the criminal justice system at all. His face was splashed across the national newspaper. They were woken up at 7 in the morning, marched for their homes and taken to Motherwell Police Station. This case went on, I think, maybe for around about 9 to 12 months. It going going to court, coming away from court, getting chucked out, didn't have time to deal with it. Yeah. For them all to get all cases, all charges to get dropped, not one person was convicted of anything that night. But because this legislation is in place, it gives the police free rein to arrest these people. It's someone that was in full employment. He's getting plastered across the front page of a national newspaper. Now, what does that say to his employers? What does it say to the mothers and fathers who are thinking that their kids are going to the football and acting like hooligans? You know, it's not necessarily just the charges that it brings. It's also the other implications of how that affects people's lives and the perception that it gives to the public that don't really understand this act.
Jane, I can't express enough how my knowledge is very limited in some of my questions. If you're listening to this thinking, please, idiot, shut up. I am trying to get you guys to talk as much as possible and me as little as possible. But there's no doubt that sectarianism is a cancer, particularly in the west of Scotland. It's a major, major issue that affects society. For me, it's not exclusive to football. I'm pretty sure it exists in every profession and every walk of life in this part of Scotland. It's a very unfortunate thing. But to pigeonhole it to football seems like an extremely dangerous thing. Of course, there are two massive organisations, one predominantly Catholic, one predominantly Protestant, in Glasgow, and that is sometimes held up as an example. But that doesn't seem to, that couldn't be further from the truth as far as I'm concerned, actually.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're spot on. I think what we've seen, what we probably already knew prior to the OBFA, but what we've certainly seen since it came in terms of how the criticism of it's been handled, football fans are an easy target in this country for that exact reason. As I said earlier at the start, you know, a lot of Scotland having their say, again, it's quite difficult because there'll be people listening who are like, oh, the OBFA, you know, I drive to the game, sit in the main stand, again, my Twitter's just all Motherwell fans, I'm not into politics and all that, and I don't have a clue about it, or I don't listen, I don't know anything about it. Everybody's in their own wee bubble, so, you know, the bubble that I'm in, probably the likes of Derek's in, you know, it's that kind of, it's a big, big issue, it's a big, big thing being discussed at the moment, and it's something that's been criticised, it campaigned on, and debated since it first came in 2012, and yet the vast majority of those 6 years, any criticisms have been purely dismissed on the basis that if you are anti the OBFA, if you are against a legislation that's designed or is you know, in place supposedly to crack down on sectarianism, then that must make you by default a bigot. Or a football hooligan who wants to behave, you know, the way you see fit. And what we've now seen is that people are now, you know, it's kind of extended. The debate's a little bit extended now. Now it's about to be repealed. More folk who simply dismissed it at first are now kind of acknowledging that it's flawed, but now saying, oh, well, it should be strengthened or it should be improved. Folk like myself in particular, and I don't mean in particular, I'm not the head of it, but since 2012, a lot of people have been asking for it to be repealed. I wasn't in that group to begin with. I was very much of the opinion that it could be improved, it could be salvaged, it could be strengthened. But every time that point was made, fingers in ears, you know, oh, you're a bigot, you're a hooligan, you just want to, there's what you're talking about, nonsense. There was absolutely no interest in giving any consideration to improving it whatsoever. And that's only now an option that it's about to be repealed. And that says more about an inevitable defeat for the Scottish Government than it does about the OBFA. The way I kind of look at it is, you know, I haven't been directly affected by the OBFA. I've certainly witnessed scenes, you know, such as St Mirren Park in 2013, which anybody who was there, I think, will remember just how absolutely ludicrous it was. So certainly witnessed the scenes. But something that I think's often been lost in the debate is it often kind of bogs down to that debate between football fans being criminalised unfairly and Scottish society saying, well, you can't possibly be against legislation that's designed to crack down on sectarianism. What often gets lost in that debate is that the Act actually has done nothing to tackle sectarianism. I don't believe that there is any Motherwell fan listening to this podcast who could hand on heart say that sectarianism has, you know, been you know, improved or start eradicated or silenced in the last 6 years. In fact, I would absolutely argue the case that sectarianism in Scottish football has been at its worst in the last 5-6 years than it had been certainly since I remember, since going to games in the early 90s. So that says it all for me. You know, you're not just talking about legislation where there's collateral damage. If we were talking about legislation that was genuinely cracking down on sectarianism, that was doing a great job of eradicating bigotry, that you could actually point to and say, look, that is working. And you also had the collateral damage of these young football fans being arrested unfairly. I'm not saying that that would be fine, but at least then there would be an argument, a counter-argument there. But there's not. The legislation does absolutely nothing to, you know, to eradicate sectarianism. We still, it was brought in to deal with the mass scenes that we all associate with sectarianism in Scottish football. You know, the mass singing, the thousands singing sectarian songs, some of which we all know. And yet that still occurs. It has occurred for 6 years. It will continue to occur, whether there will be FAs there or not, contrary to what people are now trying to, you know, make out. And that says it all for me. You don't just have legislation that's treating some people unfairly. You have legislation that is not remotely doing what it's supposed to. And so when you kind of add all those things together, it just becomes so obvious that the only place for it to go eventually is the scrap heap, which it will do on Thursday.
What's the benefits of this? It seems to arm police with a lot more authority. I always find it very strange. I mean, it happens at a lot of away games. I noticed it again happening on Saturday, the police filming the queues of Motherwell supporters, filming Motherwell supporters inside the ground. A very curious way to, a very nanny state, if you will. The Motherwell fans, not notorious for sectarian chanting, it must be said. Disorder, I don't think would extend much beyond a smoke bomb. Is there, I can't see the benefits. What are those pushing this through, arguing that it's going to achieve?
I think Jay touched on it there. The legislation seems to be failing. It was brought in, as you mentioned, after the Alan McCoy's no winning spot, which wasn't involving any football fans. It was to tackle sectarianism. It doesn't seem to be tackling sectarianism. I think one of the real concerns for me is this is a bill that was brought in to tackle sectarianism. 99% of people in Scotland are against sectarianism. There's no denying that. But the people that are really falling victim to this are the supporters of clubs that aren't sectarian. You know, as you mentioned there, on Saturday the Motherwell fans were filmed. They were probably intimidated by some police officers as well. What this has allowed Police Scotland to do is use really petty, immature bullying tactics. So you'll have Motherwell fans going to games at Inverness, for example, and this has been happening for the past 6 years. And I'm not saying that it didn't happen before the OBFA was brought in, but it's a lot more noticeable now. You'll have them going up to younger kids, calling them by their first name and saying, "Are you still working at Place X?" That is intimidation. There's nothing about it. These kids then start thinking, why do the police know my name? Why do they know where I work? We've even had instances where they've been saying, oh, are you still staying with and enlisting the girlfriend's name? That in itself should not be allowed. And the OBFA gives the police the right to do this because what it does is it funds them to a very large figure to look into intelligence about football fans. I always like to use real life examples here because we can talk about what the Act does or why it was brought in, but in practice this is an example of what happened. I was actually speaking to a football supporter the other day who's been working in a job for 4 years. He's been doing this job without any problems, but he was doing it through an agency, really, really enjoying the place where he was working. The job came up on a permanent position, and his boss says, I think you should go for this. So he went for the job, got offered the job, passed all the disclosure checks, absolutely no problem. It then went to a further police check, which is where the police can identify any soft information that they may have about this individual. It came back that the individual had been involved in trouble at football. Now, this individual has no criminal record. He's got a clean Disclosure Scotland certificate. He's never, ever been in court. But the police came back and says, because we know that he has been involved with risk groups at the football, we do not think he should get the job. Now, the person didn't get the job. So what this legislation has done is allowed police to research football fans who have no criminal record whatsoever, and then tell their employers where he's been working for 4 years that he's not suitable to do a job that he's been doing for the past 4 years. That that's just one example of what this legislation does, the powers that it gives the police, and the effect that it can have on people's lives. Now, the person in question actually appealed. He appealed the decision, and they came back and says, listen, but only we have to go with what Police Scotland says. It's quite a reputable organisation that you're working for, and we don't want to tarnish your name. I was speaking to this person the other day, and he says, even if the appeal had been won and they says you can have the job, he was ashamed. You know, he thinks he'd been into his workplace and they're looking at him thinking that he's some sort of animal. You know, he's quite a quiet person that gets on with his day-to-day life. He just enjoys going to the football and singing and waving flags. Now, that's the real-life troubles that this legislation can bring to young adults, predominantly male, you know. So it's dangerous. It really, really is dangerous. And as Jay mentioned, it looks like it's going to get scrapped on Thursday. The SNP seem to be voting as a bloc on this. As of today, there's not been any instances where any member of Parliament from the SNP look as if they're going to give in and put their hands up and say, you know what, we got this wrong. Whether that's different on Thursday, we'll soon see. But I think this is a real chance for the SNP, and I'm not having a go at the SNP as a party, I'm having a go as them on this legislation. This is a real chance for them to put their hands up and say, do you know what, we got it wrong. Let's review it and see if there's anybody else that we can go with this, because as you mentioned, Andy, it's a total cancer in society, sectarianism, specifically in the west of Scotland, and I for one think that they should be tackling sectarianism, but I don't think they should be using football as a vehicle for changing society's ills, you know, and that's the bottom line. Let's get rid of sectarianism, but let's start with education. You know, let's start with something where it really comes from. There's no doubt that Rangers and Celtic have a large element of sectarian fans, but do you think they have a large element of sectarian fans because of football, or do you think it's because of the traits that they're taught mm-hmm. at home by their parents?
Well, that's it. I mean, I mentioned, I kind of touched on earlier about how I originally started out as, you know, wanting the legislation to be strengthened. I wasn't in favour of repeal at that stage. I only kind of came around to that later. And I think that's because at the very start, you know, it was like, I suppose the expectation, rather, not even just the hope, the expectation that cracking down on sectarianism in football was going to be one of a series of measures and, you know, a final attempt to eradicate sectarianism. And I think if you were doing that, then it would be a little bit more palatable to people. Obviously, the legislation itself still needs to be far clearer. It still needs to do what it's supposed to do. But I think if you were saying, right, we've identified X, Y, and Z that, you know, might help, and this might help, and that might help, then fair enough. But what it was, essentially, was a rushed through bit of legislation in response to two managers squaring up to each other that has led to this. And that's the issue. As Derek says there, nothing's really changed in terms of education or anything like that. It's just, let's pretend it's a football problem. Let's give the suggestion that every football fan who goes to see their team is a potential bigot, and everything will be fine. And that's where the problem lies. I mean, a good example would be, you know, if one of us were out one night, and something happened, you know, it kicked off and we got lifted with breach of the peace. If it turned out, if the police found out that you'd been at the football earlier that day, it could get a whole lot worse. I mean, that could be the difference between a £65 or a £60 breach of the peace fine there and then you go about your life. Or, as Derek said earlier, you know, local press covering it, journalists at your door, police banging down your front door at 7 in the morning to arrest you because you happened to be at the football earlier. How is that right in you know, a civilised society? It just isn't. It's farcical. You know, Graham McGarry, who's been on the podcast before, wrote a great article on it in the aftermath of the England rugby coach getting abuse, I think it was at Manchester train station. And the whole reaction to that, both from, not just from the police, but from the press, from politicians, was just, and from you know, Twitter users and you know, Joe Public, was so unbelievably different than what it would have been if it had been football fans and a football manager. And that's where the issue lies. You know, it's not just a case of, you know, unfairly treating people. It's the fact that it's actually scapegoating an entire sport. If you're going to start a situation where your entire plan is to pinpoint football as being a breeding ground for sectarianism, and therefore you're going to tackle football fans more harshly than other members of the public for similar offences, which it is, we're not talking about sectarianism here. As I said, only about 22%, only about a quarter of the charges are actually sectarianism. If you're going to do that, then where does it stop? Do you start dealing out harsher, you know, do you start arresting people rather than fining them or charging them with harsher legislation because they happen to be in a pub that has a reputation for sectarianism? Do you start, you know, taking, do you start sort of giving breach of the peace to someone if they're for East Kilbride or for Hamilton, but if they're for Lack Hall or Coat Bridge, they go to jail? I mean, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about scapegoating people because there is this, you know, idea that it is somehow a breeding ground for sectarianism, and that's the issue. The whole thing is a farce from start to finish. And just to, you know, kind of touch on something that Derek said earlier there as well about the idea that it's, you know, normal football fans and it's not, you know, just Rangers and Celtic fans. You know, I was having a wee look earlier at the statistics, the Scottish Government's own statistics from the season or from the year 16-17. And I think that, you know, the top one by a mile is Rangers Hibs in the cup final, just because people ran on the park at the end mostly. But, you know, other than that, the top one isn't Rangers versus Celtic. And the sixth most arrests at a game that entire season, is it Partick Thistle versus Inverness Cali? Now, I mean, I'm sure, you know, Battle of the Thistles can be a cauldron of atmosphere and a leery event. But, I mean, come on, are you genuinely going to tell me that, you know, the sixth most sectarian football match in Scotland that year was the Jags versus Cali? I mean, come on. I mean, the evidence is there if people want to go and look at it. But the problem is, and the, you know, it keeps getting alluded to by those defending the OBFA, the kind of the go-to supporting argument is, well, most of Scotland support it. Well, of course they do, because most of Scotland don't go to football matches. Those who go to football matches, a lot of them aren't involved in this, so they don't really know the ins and outs of the act, as Derek touched upon earlier. So when you go out and you do a survey or you do a poll to, you know, 1,000 Scots, most of whom don't go to football, and you say, there's this legislation that's designed to crack down on sectarianism, do you support it? Of course they're going to say aye. But if you actually go and experience it, go and speak to people who have experienced it, and go and even just look at the stats of what we're talking about, it's so clear that it's farcical. And yeah, when Thursday comes, it'll be repealed, and then we'll no doubt be told, which we already are being told, but we'll then be told that any sectarian event after that will be because it's been repealed, rather than the fact that the OBFA never actually tackled sectarianism in the first place.
Right, we pretty much answered the full question that I was about to ask without actually me asking it, which was a good thing because I didn't really want to talk too much in this matter. But an interesting point, the rugby incident with Eddie Jones at Queen Street Station recently, or I think it was Queen Street Station. Was it?
I got that wrong then.
It might not have been, but it was Eddie Jones, definitely. it was almost seen as just leery, jovial rugby fans. And I've seen stuff down south as well where there's booze bans and travel warnings when football fans are going to be on the train. There's a rugby match on and they issue flyers saying, oh, look out for the lighthearted and boisterousness. And it's kind of completely differentiating the two sports when it's the same type of behaviour. Motherwell fans singing Motherwell songs and Saracens fans singing Saracens songs, I don't imagine are very much different on a train. It's despite the fact they're completely different sports and it's a different country, but you know exactly what I mean though. Differentiating between the two and pinpointing football seems like a very dangerous game for me. Also, I think there's an element, particularly in amongst Rangers and Celtic supporters, where if you prod them enough and goad them enough, you'll actually see an increase in the sectarian singing. It's almost like a red rag to a bull, where it will pick up a few levels. And what I think has been very noticeable, and something I've heard yourself mention, I've heard that actually mentioned in mainstream forums like Pye and Bovril and Steelman Online, where people say, listen to BT Sport, and as soon as a song starts, the producers mute it. They've actually got a control of muting the crowd. So are they actually using this to produce or to demonstrate that this is producing results?
Just to touch on your first point, Andy, the difference between football fans and rugby fans singing this train. I don't know if Jay will disagree with me here, but I think it's total class prejudice. I think that football fans are discriminated against because they're predominantly seen as working class, and rugby fans are maybe a bit higher up that pecking order in the eyes of the journalists and the media, and that's why football fans get a bit more hard time for it, you know, because they're seen as hooligans, whereas rugby fans are seen as gentlemen. There's an old saying, I'm sure, along the lines of something like that. I honestly think it is a real class issue as to why football fans are treated the way that they are in comparison to rugby fans. You're absolutely spot on as well. BT Sport and Sky have been seen to be muting out these sectarian songs by Rangers and Celtic. That is absolutely pathetic in my eyes. You know, it's first of all, if they can do that, it's almost pretending that it's not happening. You know, it's almost pretending that it's not there, rather than pointing the finger and saying, "Do you know what? This is exactly what these supporters are like." And I don't know, should you mute it? I don't think you should. I think you should let the world know, you know, this is exactly the problem that we've got in society here. And I also think it's actually worse for the game if it sounds as if it's totally quiet. If somebody's watching the game from Spain or America or wherever they watch the Old Firm from, I'm sure that Rangers and Celtic fans will tell you people got up at all hours to watch it all over the world. I'm not quite sure about that. But if you're watching it abroad, you want to hear loud stadiums. You want to see the stadiums packed out, and you want to hear songs. Whether you know the meaning of these songs in America or not, might be another question. But it's not good for the Scottish game either if you're muting it out.
It's rugby is a hooligans game played by gentlemen, and football is a gentleman's game played by hooligans. That's what it is.
That's the one.
That's the thing. But I mean, we're kind of focusing on the rugby football thing, and I actually agree to a certain extent about the class element. I don't think it's quite as, you know, obvious as that, but I think it's certainly a factor. As I said earlier, football fans are an easy target for these kind of things, you know, and that undoubtedly taps into it. That undoubtedly does play a part. But we're focusing on the rugby thing in terms of, you know, disruption and singing and all that. What about hen parties? What about stag does? What about folk just on a night out? The very fact that, you know, we could be on a train, you know, I could be on a train with you, Sparra, and you're coming back for the football, and I'm just going on a night out, and we're both behaving exactly the same, and you could be in line for some far more serious charges than I could, simply because of where you've been that day. I mean, it's farcical. The whole thing is farcical. And what's now farcical is, as kind of touched on it earlier, is a new narrative that's kind of been formed, and we've already seen it, particularly today, this idea that sectarianism is back in Scottish football, or it's got worse because the OBFA is about to be repealed. That's just absolutely laughable. You know, folk are looking at the Union Bears march yesterday. If you're telling me that that's an example of you know, what we can now expect, that the OBFA is going to be repealed, I would ask where you've been for the last 6 years, because sectarianism has been rife in Scottish football, as it has been prior to 2012. Secondly, I would point out that if you think that we live in a country where doing that on the street is, you know, needs the OBFA to tackle it, then, you know, what planet are you on? Do we not have laws and legislations to deal with that already? So why is this becoming a subject of, oh, look what happens when you repeal the OBFA, and not a subject of, why are the authorities allowing that to happen? What is wrong with this country in terms of education, etc., that Derek touched upon earlier, that these individuals feel the need to do that? It's almost whitewashed at the moment, and we can look forward to that for the, you know, the foreseeable future, if Celtic or Rangers, or in fact any other club, are kind of caught on TV or on footage online or whatever, you know, dishing out sectarianism, then it will be of a direct result of the OBFA being repealed, which is a nonsense argument. And in fact, those kind of using the Union Bears march as an example of what happens when you don't have the OBFA seem to be forgetting that the OBFA is still there, and yet it didn't prevent it. So if you want, you know, an example of how unsuccessful it is, there it is.
I don't know if I should say this. See, it might be the first time I've ever defended the Union Bears. But don't know if I should put this on record, but I certainly think that the mock outrage following that march yesterday is an absolute disgrace. I don't think they've done themselves any favours by the terminology used in their statement when they were trying to get people to come along, and I don't think it helped that they were encouraging people to wear dark shirts. But just to give you an idea of why I think that they wore the balaclavas, now I can't be certain on this, but you don't particularly see many Motherwell fans walking down the street wearing balaclavas. But as I touched on earlier, the police are gathering various copious amounts, you know, of intelligence as to where people work, as to who they live with, as to what their name is, what colour of socks they're wearing. You know, if the only reason that these people will be wearing the balaclavas is to cover their face from the police, because they don't want the police turning up at their door or at their workplace or having them saved on databases, it is a total infringement, you know, civil liberties, the way the police treat these football fans. That said, I don't think that they helped themselves with the wording that was in their statement. I'm sure they had some derogatory terms towards Irish Catholics, and I think, as Jay touched on, some of the salutes, if that's what you can call them, it didn't do them any favours either. But the reason that these kids will be covering their faces is because they don't want to be subject to police scrutiny, and they don't want to be kept on databases, you know.
So I guess, to wrap this up, the million-dollar question is, if everything goes to plan, what now? Does still exist the problem? And that is obviously going to, playing devil's advocate, that is going to be the argument, well, the issue of sectarianism hasn't been dealt with. How do we deal with it? I would suggest, certainly from listening to you guys, that pinpointing football is the hub of everything sectarian is certainly not the way to go, but... Is there a contingency plan in place? Because it still exists, and it still exists in Scottish football grounds.
Well, I think you know, I'm not getting it used, Barra, but I think that's been something I've heard quite a lot recently, the idea that, well, what's the alternative? That, to me, isn't an argument. The alternative, it's not up to me or Derek or anybody else to say this legislation is ruining people's lives, it's doing nothing to crack down on sectarianism. It's not up to us to then follow that up by saying, but here's a 20-minute PowerPoint presentation on legislation that can be brought into Scots law in the next 6 months and we'll eradicate sectarianism. You know, that's not my job, it's not my expertise. What needs to happen, and what should have happened if the Scottish Government genuinely were ashamed by that Rangers and Celtic game back in 2011, I think it would have been, if the legislation came in at 2012, then they should be, you know, giving the effort and the time and the consideration that should have been given then. It should be a proper investigative process, a consultation across society. And if the laws that are there that, you know, are designed to deal with sectarianism or hate speech or, you know, breach of the peace, if they're not strong enough and they need to be reinforced and they need to be strengthened, then fair enough, you know, argue for that, do it. But it needs to be a part of a proper campaign to eradicate sectarianism from Scotland, and that includes education, as Derek's mentioned. It includes, you know, it should include an arsenal of weapons. It should include a vast range of measures to do so. It shouldn't be, oh, it's a FIFA thing, let's crack down on the FIFA fans. That doesn't work. So that's for me the answer. The answer isn't for me to say on a Motherwell podcast on a Monday night, well, here's the legislation. I've already got a policy paper that I've cracked up and work earlier. It should be a case of, well, accept that it didn't work, accept that it was a failure, learn the lessons of why it was a failure, go back to the drawing board and spend the time coming up with legislation, if that's what's needed, to come up with, you know, measures, projects, initiatives, whatever it is, and come out with a proper plan to tackle sectarianism rather than rushing through something that is so farcical.
Guys, I think we'll wrap it up there. As I said, it's been a very informative debate for me, because I was coming in a bit blind, and yeah, certainly some very engaging and very strong arguments. It's just a shame that we didn't get the balance, but we certainly did offer many people to come on, and it always fell on deaf ears or fell through at the last minute. So thank you both for your time.
Cheers.
Thanks very much for having us on. And if you're around this weekend, make sure you get yourself along to Motherwell Makes Music.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next point. I wish you all the
I'm
best.
I'm doing this radio thing again, aren't I? I'm doing this radio thing where I start it for you and you finish it off.
Well, you actually just took the words out of my mouth, so I'm not even going to wish you good luck now. No, seriously, we do wish you all the best with the festival. Gig ourselves on, well, not ourselves, we're not playing in any gig, but we're going to a gig on Saturday night, but certainly I will be about either on the Friday or the Sunday, and if it's even half as good as it was last year, then it's going to be a tremendous success. So well done on you for getting out and organising it. I can't even begin to imagine the amount of work that's went into it, and you should get all the success it deserves.
Oh, not at all. It's good fun, and hopefully it'll be a good event this weekend. So thanks for letting us talk about that, and apologies for boring the rest of the listeners to tears with my ranting about the OBFA and why it should be gone.
Well, you've been listening to the MFC podcast. We'll be back next Monday. Until then, thank you. Goodbye.
So rolls a riot van and sparks excitement in the boys. But the policemen look annoyed. Perhaps these are ones they should avoid. Got a chase last night from men with truncheons dressed in hats. They didn't do that much wrong, still ran away though for the laugh, just for the laugh. And please just stop talking, 'cause they won't find us if you do. Oh, those silly boys in blue. Well, they won't catch me and you. Have you been drinking, son? You don't look old enough to me. I'm sorry, officer, is there a certain age you're supposed to be? 'Cause nobody told me. And up rolls the riot van, and these lads just wind the coppers up. They ask why they don't catch proper crooks. They get their address and their names took. But they couldn't care less. Kicked him in, and there was no way he could win. Just had to take it on the chin.